It's kind of our touchstone verse for this series. This is Hebrews chapter 6, verses 17 to 19. When God wanted to confirm his promise as true and unchangeable, he swore an oath to the heirs of that promise. So God has given us two unchanging things, his promise and his oath. These prove that it's impossible for God to lie. As a result, we who come to God for refuge might be encouraged to seize that hope that is set before us. That hope is real and true, an anchor to steady our restless souls. I know we talked about this a couple weeks ago, but an anchor really has only one purpose, doesn't it? And what is that? To steady the ship, right? In order to weather the storm, then what do you need? You need a good anchor, don't you? And maybe more specifically, in order to weather the storm, you need a good anchor that's hooked securely to an object stronger than the storm that you're facing. Look at the rest of verse 19. We didn't read it, but let me read the rest of verse 19. In fact, let me go back and pick up 19. That hope is real and true, an anchor to steady our restless souls. And the rest of that verse is a hope that leads us back behind the curtain to where God is. The Voice translation then adds this note: as the high priest did in the days when reconciliation flowed from sacrifices in the temple. Then verse 20 says, and back into the place where Jesus, who went ahead on our behalf, has entered, since he has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Listen, the only way to ever find true hope is to give up on all those places we've put hope that can't deliver. It's only when we give up on all that horizontal hope, all that surface hope, that we really truly find hope. That's where hope can be found. Hope's not found in our finances. It's not found in our health. It's not found in other people. Hope isn't a situation. It's not a location. It's not an experience. Hope is a person, but his name is Jesus, who, according to verse 20, has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, let me give you some context, because I'm thinking, even with the Voice translation notes, that most of us are probably at a disadvantage when we read verses and verses like this, because we don't have a clear understanding of who a priest is and what he does. Here's what you need to know. The high priest was the number one person in the Old Testament religious system. There were various levels and orders of priests in Judaism, but there was only one high priest. Here's the deal. The main job of the high priest was to represent the nation of Israel on the Day of Atonement. On that day, the high priest would go behind the thick veil, the curtain that verse 19 refers to, that separated the holy place from the most holy place. There he would offer the blood sacrifice of an innocent lamb on the golden mercy seat that sat atop the Ark of the Covenant. When the blood was offered in the way God prescribed, the sins of the people were atoned or covered for another year. And you can find all this in Leviticus chapter 16 if you need a little light reading this afternoon when you leave. Leviticus 16. And I thought this was interesting. You may not think so, but I thought it was interesting. That system was never meant to last forever. The high priest had to repeat the sacrifice every year, year after year. When one high priest died, he was replaced by another high priest who continued the yearly sacrifice on the Day of Atonement. Now that Christ has come, the sacrificial system of the Old Testament is no longer necessary. Christ has become our great high priest. The hope, verse 19 says, the hope that leads us back behind the curtain to where God is. Unlike the sacrifices of the Old Testament high priest, Christ's sacrifice never needs to be repeated. Through his death on the cross, he made a complete and final atonement for our sins. Jesus served as both the high priest who offered the sacrifice as well as the innocent lamb who was the sacrifice. Does that help? Good, because it'll come in handy as we look at this morning's promise. Again, that's kind of what we're doing through this series, is we're looking at some of the 7,487 promises found in Scripture. So with this one down, that leaves like 7,236 to go. Our passage for this morning comes from Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 to 16. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Did you all watch the debates this week? The Democratic presidential candidate debates? Yeah, me neither. And part of that is because it seems political campaigning never really ends these days, does it? I mean, we're, what, like a year and a half away from the presidential election? Candidates are continually trying to devise strategies that will net them the needed votes to make it through the primaries and onto the election. There's one campaign strategy that's always fascinated me, and fascinated probably isn't the word, but it's known as the identification strategy. And I'm sure you've seen it, and I'm sure you'll see it again. It's when a candidate visits a place like an automotive assembly plant. Are you starting to get pictures of that in your mind? And what does the candidate do? He or she puts on a pair of safety glasses, they put on a hard hat, maybe an orange vest, and then they stand next to a group of workers for like 10 or 15 minutes and awkwardly try to bolt something together while the media takes pictures of it. I guess what's so fascinating about this identification strategy is that it works. I'm amazed at the reaction of the workers in the plant. It seemed to me that workers would resent such an obvious political ploy. You'd think the workers would say, don't pretend that 10 minutes with us on the line gives you any idea of what it's like to work on an assembly line. You don't think that you can lead us to believe that you're here because you really care about us. You just want our votes. You might expect these workers to tell candidates, you're not identifying with us, you're using us. But it goes on every election, and it's apparently effective. Whether a candidate stands on an assembly line in Detroit or climbs up on a tractor in Des Moines or visits a computer plant in Southern California, this political strategy seems to be pretty widely accepted. What I'm really wondering is whether any of those candidates would be willing to take a job on those assembly lines for a year or even 6 months. Would any of those candidates actually be willing to work with these people, work next to these people on the line, eat in their lunchroom, ride in their trucks, live in their neighborhoods, live on their income? Yeah, I don't think so. I think that's why most candidates settle for the illusion of identification rather than actually identifying with their constituents. God, however, decided he wouldn't settle for the illusion. He didn't ask Jesus to come down, make a low pass, and return to heaven untouched and uninvolved. Jesus didn't come just to pose for the media for 10 or 15 minutes. He didn't come to just ponder the incredible humiliation and suffering he would have to endure and then decide to play it safe and settle for the illusion of identification. Verse 15 says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses." And I love that the NIV uses the word empathize because there's a difference between sympathy and empathy, isn't it? Sympathy, you have compassion for somebody, but empathy, you climb into the situation with them. We have a high priest who empathizes with our weaknesses, who understands what we're going through. God only knows we have weaknesses, right? And because he knows, because he understands, we find mercy and grace when we need it. And God only knows we need it. God only knows we stumble. God only knows we fall. But because he knows, because he understands, we're not left on our own. When we stumble, we're not abandoned. When we fall, we're not forgotten. God only knows, God only knows. And he understands. Theologians, and again, I'm not a theologian, an intro to theology hardly makes one a theologian. Theologians discuss this problem under the heading of incarnation. And incarnation is simply this, not that incarnation is by any means simple, but incarnation means that God became one of us. Incarnate means with meat, so it's God with meat. John 1:14 says, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." John used just one word to embody this revelation of God. Theologians have written volumes of books to explain what John sums up in a single thought: dwelt. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. He dwelt among us. I love Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of this verse in the Message. He writes, "The Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood." Isn't that good? Max Lucado, in his book, Unshakable Hope, writes, he, referring to Jesus, he writes, he was miraculously conceived, yet naturally delivered. He was born, yet born of a virgin. Had Jesus simply descended to earth in the form of a mighty king or a mighty being, we would respect him, but never would draw near to him. After all, asked Max, how could God understand what it means to be human? Had Jesus been biologically conceived with two earthly parents, we would draw near to him, but would we want to worship him? After all, he would be no different than you and me. But if Jesus was both God and man at the same time, then we would have the best of both worlds. Neither his humanity nor deity compromised. He was fully human. He was fully divine. Because of the first, we draw near. Because of the latter, we worship. Let's take another look at the passage we use as our call to worship. This is Colossians 1, 15 to 17. Again, this is from the New Living Translation. Paul writes, Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. He existed before anything was created and is supreme over all creation. For through him, God created everything in the heavenly realms and on earth. He made the things we can see and the things we can't see, such as thrones, kingdoms, rulers, and authorities in the unseen world. Everything was created through him and for him. He existed before anything else, and he holds all creation together. Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. He existed before anything was created and is supreme over all creation. Fully human, fully divine. So human, says Max, that he could touch his people. So divine, he could help them. So human, he spoke with an accent. So divine, he spoke with authority. Because Jesus was human, he understands us. Because he's divine, he can help us. Jesus is absolutely the right person to hear our prayers because he has entered the Holy of Holies. He has ascended into heaven, going back to our passage from Hebrews 4, verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, which is his human name, the Son of God, which is his divine title, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. He's Jesus, his human name, the Son of God, his divine title. The King James Version of verse 15, I love this version, says that Jesus is touched with the feeling of our infirmities. He is touched by our weaknesses. What touches us touches him. To say I feel your pain has become almost a cliche, hasn't it? But not so in Jesus' case. He feels our pain. Jesus is moved by our sorrow. He's aware of our tears. He's touched by our failure. Jesus knows what we're going through. Verse 15, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet he did not sin. Isn't it good to know that he was tempted just as we are? The text says Jesus faced every kind of temptation we face. I also found this interesting. You can let me know later if you find it interesting. Basically, every temptation falls into one of three categories: the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. And I found this in 1 John 2, 14 to 17, if you want to check me on it. Jesus defeated the devil in all three of these areas, didn't he? When we fail, where we failed, he succeeded. Where we gave in, he stood strong. Where we collapsed under the pressure, Jesus obeyed. He was tempted, yet he never sinned. He never gave in. Now, some have pointed to the sinlessness of Jesus as evidence that he can't fully understand us. If Jesus never sinned, they reason, how could he understand sin? And you might want to ask the same question. If Jesus never sinned, how could he understand sin? That's a great question. I'm so glad that you asked. And the answer, to answer your question, it is relatively simple. Jesus felt it more than we do. We give in to it. He never did. Listen to what C.S. Lewis had to say about that in his book, Mere Christianity. Lewis writes, a silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie, says Lewis. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is, After all, you find out the strength of the German army by fighting against it, not by giving in. You find out the strength of the wind by trying to walk against it, not by lying down. A man who gives in to the temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would be after an hour. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. He goes on to say, Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the full what temptation means. Because Christ was tempted in every way, just as we are, and never gave in, we can then, verse 16, approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. We don't have to worry that we'll somehow shock him with our prayers, do we? You can't shock him with your prayers, by the way. God only knows he's heard it all. God only knows he's seen it all. We can then go ahead and be totally honest about our failures, because God only knows he knew about them before we even mentioned them. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. Jesus took on the consequences of sin, our sin. According to 1 Corinthians 5:21, for God made Christ, who never sinned, to be the offering for our sin, so that we could be made right with God through Christ. He didn't deserve to feel the shame of sin, but he felt it. He didn't deserve the humiliation, but he experienced it. He had never sinned, yet he was treated like a sinner. Jesus became sin for us. All the guilt, all the remorse, all the embarrassment that we may have ever felt, God only knows, Jesus understands it. There's a really cool song. It's by For King and Country that I'd like to sing for you, but I don't sing, so I'm going to read the lyrics to you. Actually, I talked to Tyler about it. He's going to see if he can pull it together for the next time that he's here, which is on the 14th. But let me share these lyrics with you. Wide awake while the world is sound asleep, too afraid of what might show up while you're dreaming. Nobody, nobody, nobody sees you. Nobody, nobody, nobody would believe you. Every day you try to pick up all the pieces, all the memories, they somehow never leave you. Nobody, nobody, nobody sees you. Nobody, nobody, nobody would believe you. God only knows what you're going through. God only knows what they say about you. God only knows how it's killing you. But there's a kind of love that God only knows. You keep a cover over every single secret, so afraid if someone saw them, they would leave. But somebody, somebody, somebody sees you. Somebody, somebody will never leave you. God only knows what you're going through. God only knows what they say about you. God only knows how it's killing you. But there's a kind of love that God only knows. For the lonely, for the ashamed, for the misunderstood, for the ones to blame. What if we could start over? We could start over. We could start over. Over the lonely, for the ashamed, the misunderstood, and the ones to blame. What if we could start over? We could start over. We could start over. Because there's a kind of love that God only knows. God only knows what you're going through. God only knows what they say about you. God only knows the real you. But there's a kind of love that God only knows. God only knows where to find you. God only knows how to break through. God only knows the real you. There's a kind of love that God only knows. I'm going to spend a little bit of time here at the rail, and I invite you to come and just spend a moment with him. Would you please stand as we sing our closing hymn?